Thank you for listening. This is the Legends Podcast by All Day Vinyl, and I'm your host, Scott Duddleson. After you finish this episode, please subscribe, rate, and check us out on Instagram and YouTube at All Day Vinyl. Today, I'm excited to speak with a legend. This gentleman is a Rock and Roll Hall of Fame member, producer who helmed Rocky Erickson's best solo album, The Evil One, member of pioneering country rock band Southern Pacific, and most notably co-founder and bass player of Creedence Clearwater Revival, in my opinion, the greatest American rock band ever. I'm pleased to introduce to you a legend, Stu Cook. Thank you so much, Stu, for joining.
Good afternoon.
Appreciate your time today. So we're gonna start from the now and move our way back. And the now is that you're retired and you're enjoying the retirement. But up until a few years ago, you were touring for the last 25 years with your compadre Doug Cosmo Clifford in Clearwater Revisited. So tell me why it was time to end that project after that 25 years.
Well, 25 years is a pretty good career, especially when you're having it off the same catalog. We never expected it to be as popular as it became. It just started off as an idea to maybe, you know, get out of the house, play a little music for corporate events, charities, things like that. And it evolved into a full-time project for 25 years, between 120 and 180 days of the year away from home. Became quite a monster, actually. We had a great time. We saw the world multiple times in the band, but it just seemed that, we'd been there, we'd done that, and it's time to move on, do something else with our lives. You know, we're not, I like to say there's way more sand in the bottom of the glass than there is in the top of the hourglass. And I mean, we could have played a few more years, I guess. We've both been concerned about the quality of the show. We, held ourselves to some pretty high standards over the years. And because it was an uphill fight, nobody said, we didn't get permission to do this. Most people thought we were crazy when we started, that we could never do it without the original lead singer. And so every show we had to put it down and make sure people believed it. And after 25 years of beating ourselves up on the road, we had to ask ourselves, is this still as good as it was 5 years, 10 years ago? And the honest answer was, we're losing a step or two here and there. The audience may or may not know it, but we do. As a result, we had to have the final revival tour.
Do you still find the need after that project ended to play these songs? Do you find yourself out and performing with anybody?
I hang out with a bunch of other people, not regularly, but maybe once a month. And we might play one or two Creedence songs, but mostly songs by other popular artists over the years, our favorite artists. There's four or five of us, and then we get together in a guy's garage and we have a little PA set up and do some videoing, and everybody plays and sings, whatever songs that they know, and everybody knows each other's songs. I wanted to mention that the universe must have had something in mind for us, because possibly 1 month after we played our final show in Aguascalientes, Mexico, we played Mexico City and Aguascalientes at the end of February 2020. And it wasn't 30 days later and the whole world was shut down from the pandemic. So the industry went away. Even if we'd wanted to continue,
right,
we couldn't have.
The universe took you back to right where you started, which is in the garage playing covers
yeah,
with some friends.
Now I'm singing Eric Clapton and Tom Petty songs with my friends. And, like I said, an occasional Creedence song thrown in there, but we don't have a drummer, so I don't play bass. I play guitar. It's not much fun playing bass unless you got a good drummer, which I've had. Been fortunate enough to play with three great drummers over my career: Doug Clifford, Keith Knudsen from the Doobie Brothers, and a couple of years in Revisited, when Doug was ailing, we played with a fellow by the name of Ron Wixo, who's just a monster And so, you know, I've always had a good drummer to bounce off of. So I've been extremely fortunate. Yeah. But so now without a set of drums, there's not much sense of me playing bass. So I enjoy playing guitar and easier to sing with.
And so, you know, you mentioned Doug Cosmo. He's been your drummer for 60 years, over 60 years.
I met Doug in the first day of school in the seventh grade.
Yeah. Tell me about how, I mean, you guys are, obviously Creedence got big in the mid to late 60s, but you were one of the early bands. I mean, 1957, 59, you said 57 was when you met him?
Yeah, you know, it could have been 57, I think 57, something like that, 57, 58. First day of school in the seventh grade, junior high. We were in the same homeroom, same letters for our last name, right? So that's where we met. And then we formed the Blue Velvets with John Fogerty a year later when we were in the eighth grade.
How did you all connect with each other that you all are musicians and not just classmates?
Well, we weren't really musicians per se. We were just fans. And it turned out we have pretty much the same record collection. And so we shared our love for, you know, the early rock and roll artists and early blues guys. But of course, you know, when rock and roll really exploded, guys like Ricky Nelson, Fats Domino, Little Richard, Jerry Lee Lewis, Carl Perkins, Larry Williams, we all loved that stuff. You know, it really got us going. So then we were just an instrumental trio, and we played boys clubs and county fairs, and eventually got a little bit older. Once we got our driver's license, we could play fraternity parties and things like that.
Were you were in a small town? Were there other bands in the vicinity, or were you guys holding?
We were pretty much the only band, actually, that I recall. In fact, our high school used to send us to other high schools, what they called exchange assemblies, and we would go represent El Cerrito High. We'd go play at Alameda High or Encinel High or Richmond High, one of the other local high schools, and entertain them for their assembly. You know, their student once a week, once a month, everybody in the whole school gets together in the gym, right? And so we got to take the whole morning off to go do that, and then we got the afternoon off. So it was paying off
early.
That's
a pretty sweet deal.
Yeah, it was paying off early. But though there really weren't any other bands in our age group around that we were aware of. I mean, by the time the Stones and the Beatles arrived, everybody had a band, you know, or wanted to be in a band.
Yeah. You guys were veterans by that time.
Yeah, seasoned veterans. You know, we'd been playing. We learned how to play together. You know, we learned our instruments at the same time, and we sort of developed a sixth sense, you know, where we just felt where what each other was going to do, and it made putting it together when we actually played, it sounded more professional, even though we weren't. But we, you know, we had the advantage of having been doing it for several years by the time the mid-60s came around. You know, we actually started playing in 59, I believe. I think we made our first recording in 1959, actually. Yeah. I think it was in the band 2 weeks, and we were in the recording studio with Tom Fogerty, John's older brother. We were his backup band for many years. Yeah, I think that's all pretty accurate.
I've done a bunch of interviews, and a lot of people cite, you know, the Beatles and Rolling Stones as the impetus for bands to start writing original songs. But you guys were writing, or Tom and John were writing songs in the early 60s before that. Was that a unique element in the music scene from your perspective?
It may have been. I never thought about it much. As an instrumental trio, we played all of, you know, we played the Ventures, I mean, Johnny and the Hurricanes, and there was a few other notable bands that were without vocalists at the time. Link Wray was an artist that did instrumentals, and instrumentals were could become a pop hit too. You know, I mean, most of popular music, as I recall back in the 50s, was sort of popified country. In other words, you know, Patsy Cline would be a country star, but then she could have a pop hit, a big, you know, she could be number one on the national charts, not just country, but, you know, the popular music charts in Billboard, the Hot 100, I guess they called it. And that happened over and over again. Country artists were the easiest to cross over. Black artists, rhythm and blues artists, the hardest. You know, they had to have their own radio stations, and, you know, they were like a subset of popular music, still popular amongst their fans, but not as broad, nearly as broad a fan base. And then, you know, honestly, that was racism, you know, prevalent in sports, prevalent in entertainment, prevalent everywhere in America back in the 50s and the 60s, and to some extent in the 21st century, you know, hasn't gone away yet. But the original songs, I mean, just seemed like the natural thing to do. When you run out of other people's songs, why not? You know, they're not, by then, if you learn a bunch of other people's songs, you realize that there's no mystery to music. There's only 12 notes in the Western scale. And if you listen to popular music, there's only three or four chords that are used over and over and over in mostly the same order pattern. So then it's just coming up with the, you know, a new idea, a new story.
So how did you all go from a regional band to end up connecting with Fantasy Records to get your first incarnation of CCR out, the Gollywogs?
Well, you know, when we were making these early records, we were backing up other artists besides Tom. We were on a little label called Orchestra. Then there was a black artist that we backed up, name of James Powell. I forget the name of the label that he was on, but there was a bunch of small independent labels in the San Francisco Bay Area, and Fantasy was one of them. Actually, they were probably the biggest small independent label, and they made their mark by being some of the early, doing the early recordings of artists that went on to become huge in jazz genre, including Brubeck, Montgomery, Cal Jader, Bolasette. Of course, Vince Guaraldi was how we ended up at Fantasy. Vince Guaraldi recorded the music to a movie called Black Orpheus, and the theme song was "Cast Your Fate to the Winds." And they were on Fantasy, and we thought, well, you know, here's, and it was a hit, number one hit, another instrumental that was a hit, way bigger than the movie, and which was sort of like an international film festival winner, Brazilian, as I think I mentioned. So we thought, well, here's a Bay Area local label that has a hit. Let's take our stuff over there. And so Tom and John went over there with our tapes, and they were being run by a couple of beatniks, the Weiss brothers, Max and Saul. And Max offered us a contract. And so we signed with him and his brother, and Max became our manager, and he named us the Gollywogs without asking us.
And
so we get the records. The record, you know, we do our first recording when the box of records comes, and we open it up, and we go, "Who the Gollywogs?" You know, we're looking at these brand new 45s in a white envelope.
And what did you think you were going to be recording as?
We were going to be either the Blue Velvets or the Visions. We thought we might be the Visions at that time, but somewhere, you know, along the way, Max thought that it didn't sound British enough, right? The British invasion, and so, you know, get hip, baby. That was Max. Pink socks, glow in the dark socks, sandals, beard. You know, just a regular San Francisco beatnik, part of that whole beat generation, which was closely tied to the West Coast jazz. And so we were on, we ended up on Fantasy after he sold the company to Saul Zantz and some partners of his. Saul offered us a contract and offered to buy John an amp. So we said, sure, nobody else is offering us any. We never got any other offers. It's not like there was a big, bidding war. We took the contract. The guy said, "Hey, your dad's a lawyer. Let's see what he thinks." And so I took the contracts to him, and he looked at him and he says, "Fuck, I don't know. I'm not in the music business, but I can tell you one thing. I don't see any other offers for you guys. So if you really want to make records, this is the deal that you have to take." And so it was our decision to at least, take the leap, regardless of the terms of the deal, which weren't great, but they're roughly equivalent to the same deal the Beatles signed, an entry level, low royalty rate. They take your publishing, that kind of a deal. And so there we were. We were in showbiz.
And is that the contract that John Fogerty famously was trying to get out of over the years?
Yeah. He's been trying to get out of a lot of deals that he signed. Sometimes he signed them over and over and he still didn't like them. It didn't get any better each time he signed them. I wonder why he did that. But regardless, yeah, we were always with Fantasy and they always gave us a crappy deal. And that's the same deal we have today.
And that allowed you to start, obviously, you did the Gollywogs and that transformed into CCR. And right. You ultimately put out the first record, self-titled, and it had Susie Q on it. Was Susie Q, that must have been a song. It was obviously a Dale Hawkins song that right. In the late 50s you grew up with. Was that in your concert repertoire prior to recording it?
Well, it wasn't. It was, then it wasn't, then it was again. We always liked it. So we played it pretty regularly. Then the Stones recorded it. And said, "Well, we're already playing it, in our 4-hour shows, four 1-hour sets. We were already playing a bunch of Stones songs." So we covered the Stones. We didn't cover the Beatles, but because we were, more of a R&B outfit. I mean, our inclinations were more like theirs, before they started writing, they played American blues. So we stopped playing it. And then just about the time I think we'd already decided to become CCR. We were playing a show up in north of Sacramento, real close to one of the military bases. This is during the Vietnam War. So we had a lot of, I think it was an Air Force base. So there were a lot of airmen there. And anyway, we're playing like 4 hours a night, 5 hours a night. And we just ran out of songs to play by the end of the night. You could repeat like 3 hours in, you could start the show over because by then everybody that was there at the beginning had already left. So we could start over. But by the fifth set, it was like, what do we do for 50 minutes? And I suggested that we just, psychedelic long jams and so on were becoming the rage in the San Francisco scene, which Creedence really wasn't a part of, although we played the same venues and, knew a lot of the same people. We weren't a San Francisco scene band per se. We were more focused on top 40, the 3-minute song. But I suggested to the band that we just play Susie Q and then just jam for 20 minutes. And that'd get us, almost halfway through our last set. And I said, we'll just play the 3 verses. We'll do the regular solo, come back and do another verse. And then we'll just jam, until people fall down. So we did that from then on. It became part of our repertoire again. So we recorded the long version. I think we got it pretty quick, 1 or 2 takes. And the record company released it as a single. The A side was the lyrics, the vocal part. And the B side was the jam. So that's the story on that song.
And you mentioned the psychedelic scene in San Francisco. And there's a story that circulated around for years. And that story is that you all went to maybe the Fillmore, to the Grateful Dead, and watched them play. And at that show, made a decision that you weren't going to go in that psychedelic realm and you were not going to do drugs. And this was a whole scene that was you know, you were going to make a concerted effort to avoid?
Well, that's just a story, what they call it, urban myth.
Yeah.
We always maintained that partying and performance didn't mix. And to that end, we never drank, we never got high before we played. After we played, another story. But and we weren't in our whole approach was not let's get high and see what happens. You know, ours was like, okay, we got 12 songs, you know, 2.5, 3.5, 4 minutes. I think one of our, I think Born on the Bayou is over 5 minutes, okay, as a song. But most of them were, you know, short AM type singles. And that was our approach, because we wanted to, there was no FM radio when we started. If you wanted to make a mark, to have hits, they had to be 2.5, 3.5 minutes long and be played on top 40. And so that was always our goal. And so I wouldn't say we were over rehearsed, but we were always focused what we're trying to do. And you know, we knew what we needed to do to pull it off, and getting drunk and getting high didn't fit with, you know, doing good consistently. But anybody comes home from work, right? They have a drink, you know, get high, whatever. Yeah, we had normal lives when we weren't being professional.
I mean, you guys were so prolific. I want to go into a little depth on, you know, specifically 1969, Bayou Country, Green River, Willie and the Poor Boys. You were so prolific. On the high level, what is that like for you in terms of all that action?
Well, that was a big year for sure. I don't think any band had done that. No American artist had done that. The Beatles were pretty prolific as well. But the truth be known, Bayou Country was recorded in 1968.
Right, the end of the year, right?
It was released in January 69. So we had three releases in the years 1969, but we only recorded two full albums that year. Our style of recording was record the A and the B side, record an A and a B side, record another A and a B side, and then go in and record the rest. And that's how we made an album. It wasn't until, I think, Pendulum, when we actually went into the studio and recorded all the songs at once. So the first album was recorded that way. So first and second album were recorded all at once as well. But from Green River, Willie and the Poor Boys, Cosmos Factory, were all recorded in chunks in between touring.
Those two albums that were recorded in full, were they done quickly, or were these sessions that you guys had to perfect out?
No, we played live. You know, we'd do 2, 3, 4 takes of a song. If it wasn't happening, we'd move on to another song, come back, always try to catch it fresh. I never, as a bass player, I mean, I never really said, this is the part, I have to play this part every single time. I played it different every take. I played something different, you know, just a little bit. Only I would know, really, or somebody who was, you know, A-B-ing the bass parts, the bass track from one take to another would notice it immediately. But, you know, it was within the general part in the groove. You know, if I did something in the first verse, I wouldn't do it in the third verse or something, you know, just kind of flip ideas around. They were always bouncing around. It could be this way, it could be that way. You know, it doesn't make any difference. Just play it as good as you can. And as long as the take would be when everybody played it as good as they can at the same time.
Yeah.
And we usually, I mean, some of it is amazing. Some of the, like, I Heard It Through the Grapevine, I think, was like the first or second take. Keep On Chuglin, same. Susie Q, very, very quick. We rehearsed every day, 4 or 5 hours a day, you know, Monday through Friday at Cosmos Factory. The original factory was just a tool shed in Doug Clifford's backyard. But Yeah, it was a job. It was a task. You know, the goal was to get better, to make better records, to play better, to get the brass ring, right?
Give me a little slice of life of what the factory was like on a day where you would all have to, John, bring in a song and you all have to rehearse or learn. What does that look like at that time period?
Well, the factory was the Cosmos Factory, which became the factory. Was in the sort of the warehouse district of Berkeley, California, down by Interstate 80. And what was it? 1230 Fifth Street, Berkeley, CA. We'd drive in, we'd get there like 10:30. There was inside parking. The crew rolled up the big metal door. We roll in, have some coffee, maybe shoot some pool, then go back to the rehearsal area that you see on the cover of Cosmos Factory, and set about whatever the task of the day was. If it was a new song, here's how it goes. Here's my idea. John would play it, sing it, as much as as if the lyrics weren't done, he'd just kind of say, "Well, this is the melody. This is what I'm thinking right here." And then we just start playing it together. And Doug would say, "How about what if I do this here?" And, John would say, "No. Maybe not that, maybe not there, maybe not that, maybe not anywhere. And try this," and Doug, "try that." And you go, "Well, I think this needs that there." You say, "Go ahead, try it." Say, "Yeah, that's good." And each person, some of the stuff's obvious. I mean, like you look at a song like Bad Moon Rising, it's just a one note bass part. It doesn't even go boom, 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 boom. It goes boom, 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 boom. It's like, okay. Nobody had to show me that, except maybe to, play less, right? Don't make it sound so country. So a lot of the stuff is obvious. A lot of the stuff, John had specific ideas that he wanted us to try. It just would depend on how we approached it. Like one of the really cool things that Doug just kind of forced into a song was at the end of "We'll Stop the Rain," there's on the fade out, there's a lot of drum action, a lot of drum rolls and things like that. And John didn't like them. Doug said, "No, I love them. I'm gonna I'm gonna keep playing them." I don't know if John ever liked them, but they're on the record.
I've seen footage from the factory and you all hanging out, and you, Doug, look so relaxed, so cool, so chill. Did you feel that there was camaraderie during these times, or was it? Do you look back fondly at that era?
I have to look at the whole career with a whole lot of fondness. It's been quite a blessing. We got extremely lucky, and that's really what it is in this business. It's how good you are is not as relevant as how bad you want it. And how hard you try. And then, there's the universe has to line up. So that radio will play your song and people will like it and request it. And then it'll end up in the record stores or, then you get to do another record. But, the whole period, like anything fresh and new, it started out great. I mean, we started out in junior high school, right? It was an adventure in learning to drink beer and, grow up. The more successful we got, the more stress the whole project came under. And so I don't know specifically what time frame you're relating to me.
And I want to go back to 69 real quick on Born on the Bayou. There's a story about that song being birthed at the Avalon on stage during a sound check. Do you have any memory of that moment?
I do. Yeah. We were like fifth on the bill. Taj Mahal was the headliner. A bunch of other local acts. When I say local acts, I mean, might have been Quicksilver, or might have been, other Bay Area, San Francisco scene bands. Taj Mahal was like a national artist at the time, you know? And so we were like fifth on the bill, right? We were going to play first. So we were last to sound check. And we were up, you know, trying to get a sound, and John started playing the, you know, once we pretty much worked our way through the sound check, we were just kind of goofing off, and John started playing the riff for Born on the Bayou. You know, that guitar part that's at the intro, and throughout the song, actually. And so we all just started jamming on that, you know, Doug is hitting the quarter notes on the bell, the cymbal, and we're cooking along, so one of the production people got all over us, said, you know, why don't you guys, you know, you knock it off, get off the stage. You guys are not going anywhere. You know, that sucks. Scram. That's what I remember of it. It was like the birth of the song was tainted by somebody else's opinion of where we were headed.
And how long after does from an event like that, does the song actually come back to y'all to?
Within a year.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we were, that was in 68, and like, you know, Bayou Country came out in early 69, and it was a flip side of Proud Mary.
Then in 1970, y'all went to Europe to tour, and there was just a documentary that came out. A lot of great footage of y'all playing.
Oh yeah. The Royal Albert Hall. Yeah, that, you know, we nobody could ever agree on who owned it between us and the record company, and you know, John had a lot of problems with all the people there, and his own problems got mixed in with Creedence's problems, so nothing ever happened with it. It just sat there, and there was a lot of that documentary style footage that was shot with it that nobody knew what to do with. No one ever sat down and said, "Here's what we got. Just make something out of this," until, well, 3-4 years ago, I guess, when Sig Sigworth at Kraft, which is one of the Concord Music Group's labels that deals with catalog. They're more of a catalog. I don't know that Fantasy is, I don't really know what's going on over there, but Kraft is the brand, and Sig became the producer of the, one of the producers of the project, and he landed the dude to narrate.
Right.
Which, you know, like, come on, what could be better?
The biggest Creedence Clearwater Revival fan, for sure.
Yeah, not too big a CCR fan at all. And I mean, how many times have I watched The Big Lebowski, you know?
Oh my God, me too. They call me the dude. My last name is Duddleson. In fact, I've got on my shirt right here, it says dude, the dude.
Yeah,
he's a hero.
So anyway, that was a great show. The only thing missing was the encore, you know. By then, I guess John had somehow decided, another management decision, okay, a poor management decision, that the band would no longer do encores because they were phony. You know, my feeling was, yeah, you know, I can see where if you hadn't played well enough in your own mind, you might not think that you earned an encore. But my God, if the audience wants an encore,
right,
you must have fooled them, right? If you didn't think you did that well, and they did, who are you going to side with? You know, you're going to always side with your fans. And so we didn't do an encore, but it was quite a show. All of our concerts were a little on the short side, I felt, but you know, that was sort of the norm until, you know, the Grateful Dead and so on, you know, then the long shows, you know, Springsteen and, you know, everybody started doing 2.5, McCartney even for a while was doing, you know, full feature length concerts, but ours were like 45, 55 minutes. And so it wasn't a long production, which is, you know, why I guess they didn't feel at the time that there was enough actual footage to make a special out of. But when they finally figured out how they were going to use some of the B-roll, it just so happened that Saul Zantz had hired some some guy with a 16 millimeter camera to follow us around while we were on tour, and we had no idea who he was or what the point of it was. But I mean, nobody would talk to him very much. I talked to him all the time because I was interested in photography.
What I loved a lot about that, the Royal Albert Hall show, and that was one of my first times seeing a full concert. But I loved how you all are arranged on stage with Cosmo up front in the line. You usually don't see that kind of arrangement where the front man isn't in front, and the drummer isn't in the back.
Yeah, well, that's all, Revisited went with the drum riser and the drums in the back.
Right.
Yeah.
How did you all come upon that unique formation as a stage show?
Nightclubs, little bars that we played in. I mean, there wasn't room for much of anything. I preferred being on the other side of Doug, the hi-hat side, where the side where John was. I thought I could have locked in a little better if I could be on that side. But the way we had it is, you know, there's the way we did it in the bars, where the stage was, you know, not very deep, not very wide.
Tom Fogerty, any anecdotes you could share about Tom? I'm a fan of his solo albums.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Fan of his work.
I got it. Yeah. You know, Tom was the first guy to leave the band, sort of like that was the first big crack in what had been a solid team since 1959. And he felt that he just didn't have any space in the band. You know, he was the original singer, and he turned it over to John because he felt John had a more rock and roll voice. It's what we needed at the time. This was in, let's say, 1967, 66, 67, 67, I want to say. And then, you know, after we'd had 3, 4, 5 hit albums, Tom wanted to more room within the band, wanted to write, at least, you know, offer songs, present songs. And I think he might have wanted to sing a song or two. Sort of like, you know, Ringo sang a few, right? Even let, you know, they let Ringo sing. George sang a couple. But, you know, it was really Lennon McCartney's ball. Oh, man, the Dolphins are jumping like mad in front of my house.
Very nice.
And so, you know, after a while, he just got tired of John turning him down. So he went solo. And he rented a space like one or two doors down from Cosmos Factory as his rehearsal place, where he put together his band Ruby with Randy Oda. And he had a really cool rhythm section. I forget the name of the guys, but a couple of black kids. They were, they had a good band. And in fact, Doug and I played on a couple of his solo albums. I played lead guitar on Joyful Resurrection. I mean, we supported Tom. Tom must have quit a half a dozen times. Doug and I talked him out of it. You know, come on, Tom, you know, John will change his mind. And he goes, I don't think so. Well, give it a little, you know, give him another shot at it. And he, you know, a couple months later, nah, I'm out of here. No, things are going too good. Don't leave now. No, I can't take it anymore. I don't need it. You know, he's my brother. He won't even let me do this, that. Anyway, Doug and I felt like we were squeezed in like a Fogerty sandwich between the two of them. But, you know, we kept it together as long as we could. I used to see Tom play around the Bay Area all the time. Then he started hanging out with Jerry Garcia and the Merle Saunders and jamming with those guys. John Kahn was a bass player, I think.
Yeah, anyway, those great records they did. I love those. Yeah. Those are my favorites.
Really, yeah. Really. You know, Merle was a great guy. Merle was like one of the original guys that we met on Fantasy Records. He'd been there forever. The Chinese guy Edwin that worked in the warehouse called him Molo Shono. I don't know where that came from, but Merle was Molo Shono. And so yeah, Tom had a lot of music in him, and it was a shame that it didn't fit, you know, as we evolved and became more and more you know, almost a parody of ourselves, I guess, you know, after a while, if you don't really, you know, Creed just stopped really growing. When John, by the time John had fully taken control of the band, it just became like, okay, here we go again. You know, not that we weren't having hit records and you know, making good money and so on, but the excitement had slipped away because it just didn't feel like a band anymore. You know, it was more like it's becoming more and more John's solo project with three other guys. And I mean, to all I can say is to that is, how many hit records have you had since you got rid of the guys that were holding you back? You know, one. So, yeah, I mean, if we had a real manager, he would have said, hey, kids, settle down and let me explain some things to you about, you know, where you are, where you've been, and where you're likely to go, and, you know, how we can best manage this so that, you know, you have the most success possible, everything that you can earn, you will get. But we didn't have a mentor. We thought Saul Zenz was a mentor, but it turned out that he was not. He was not, you know, to him, it was just a piece of paper. You know, the contract was just business. And when we signed with him, he said, you know, this is just a start. If you guys get successful, we'll tear this up and all share in the pie equally. Well, you know, after a couple of hit albums, and we went back in and said, well, what about that pie? He said, I think I'm going to live with this contract I have. So, you know, things like that definitely took away, you know, changed everybody's perspective. You know, I mean, first we thought we were all on the same team, you know, and gradually that chipped away at, you know, it wasn't just success. It was, along with the success, there was, you know, some very poignant disappointments that just led to, you know, the lack of enthusiasm, the lack of, you know, the spark. The spark went because of all the internal BS, such as life.
You guys, the legacy you left before then is absolutely insane, and will live forever.
I mean,
forever.
There's nothing at all wrong with my screen just keeps popping off of the Zoom. There we go. There's nothing wrong with our stuff.
It's the
best. I'm glad to hear it. I'm glad, you know what, I'm really glad that so many younger people have turned on to it. It's we're more popular now than we've ever been.
Sure. I mean, and it will continue
with the streaming and that stuff. I thought, you know, catalog music would just go by the wayside. It would just be, you know, hip hop and R&B and pop music and so on. But I mean, in the last 5 years, we've gone from less than on a streaming, just looking at streaming, we've gone from less than 10 million listeners a month to over 33 million listeners a month. So it's, I guess, you know, each new format has been very kind to our legacy.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And before we wrap, let's talk about Rocky Erickson, because for the listeners, just to give some context, Rocky Erickson was a legendary psychedelic rock pioneer in Austin, Texas in the late 60s with the 13th Floor Elevators. And in the late 70s, you hooked up with them to produce two of his first solo albums, which are amazing. Well, I Know Evil One, and that's like some of Rocky's most seminal songs. I Walk with the Zombie, Two-Headed Dog.
Yeah.
I mean, these are great. So tell me how you hooked up, because that seems like an odd, first of all, the music is rock, serious rock. So it makes sense that you're in there, but Rocky as a personality doesn't seem one that you're connecting with. So tell me the story of how this happens.
Okay, this guy that I was smoking weed with was Rocky's manager. And one day he asked me if I'd be interested in going to the studio with Rocky. And I said, oh my God, yeah. You know, he's one of the greatest rock and roll vocalists, you know, of the period. One of them ever, really. You know, I mean, that guy could scream his ass off. And so we got introduced, and Rocky had this, he was always testing. He had this kind of, his personality was that he would do stuff just to provoke, just to see how you would react. And once I passed the test, you know, we went in the studio and I worked closely with his musical director, Dwayne Aklaskin, lead guitar player in the Aliens. And Bill Miller, the electric auto harp player, was also instrumental in helping me get inside of Rocky's head. They'd known each other for quite a while. I think he might have been from Texas as well. But yeah, you know, Rocky was, sometimes he was there, sometimes he wasn't. You know, he had a lot of personal struggles. He ran into some problems with the law and marijuana early on in Texas, which was never a good thing. And rather than go to jail, they put him in a mental institution, which didn't help him out much, you know. In fact, when we were recording The Evil One, we were doing the vocals down in Austin at a studio owned by this guy. What's his name? Maybe it'll come to me. Anyway, he wrote the song Muskrat Love for Captain and Tennille. He's like a Texas legend kind of guy. Anyway, he owned this studio, and I'd have to put on a coat and tie and go up to the Rusk Mental Institution and check Rocky out and take him down the studio. We do the vocals, and after a while, he'd start to drift, you know, start talking to his manager about, you know, what about that apartment you're going to get me, Craig? And I said, Rocky, I think we're done. We're done for the day. Drive him back. Whenever I went to get him, you know, I had the coat and tie on, and all the other inmates would come up to me and say, hey, can you get me out? Can you get me out? And I go, well, finally, I'm just trying to figure out what's going on. So I asked one of the supervisors what's going on, and they said, oh, you got a coat and a tie on. They think you're a doctor. And they see you getting Rocky out. They want to know if you can get them out too. But yeah, you know, working with Rocky was where I really learned how to be a producer, you know, just how to get more out of an artist with their cooperation, you know, just try to keep everything positive. Don't try and work it to death, you know, try and keep the flow, you know, loose and things naturally. And, you know, don't worry about little things, you know, a little out of tune here, a little this, little that. Yeah, you know, whatever. You know, but are you, you know, is the performance good? Is it real? Boy, Rocky was real when he was really performing. I mean, there was just nobody could top him. He would nail it. He would know, he'd say, I want to go back and do this part. Let's try and do this and do this again. And so he was involved when he was there. You know, when he was focused, he was really there. And he was funny. Oh my God. I would always run a two-track tape machine always when we were working so that I could capture everything that, you know, like the in-between takes while we're rewinding the tape, we'd be talking and Rocky would be blowing our minds with things. And so we recorded everything. I don't know where that stuff is, because his manager just recently passed away. I think there's a guy in Texas that may have access to all those archives. But I mean, hours and hours of stuff. And sometimes we couldn't fit it all on the 16 track. So I would have, rather than erase something that we already had that we weren't sure, you know, we didn't want to stop to comp it down, you know, and free up the tracks, I would just record it on the two track, and then we'd just wild sync it in, you know, we just like push record, push start, you know, and hope that it dropped in. And because we couldn't manipulate it like you can with digital, you know, drag it a beat or a half a beat, half a second this way or that way. And so it took hours and hours and hours to do some of this stuff. But sometimes Rocky'd bring in a song and he had it all kind of backwards. You know, he had it all there, but it would be backwards from a song, a story point of view. Like he'd be singing the last verse first, for example. And so I would have to, you know, rearrange it all for him, you know, get the band bored and, okay, this is the way it's going to be. This is the way you're going to do it always. And My biggest thrill was when we finished with the evil one and Rocky heard it. And he said, you know, I really like that. I think Stu did a great job. And he used to call me Buzzy. He buzzes around all the time. Where'd you come up with that? He says, you're just always buzzing around. You know, and I'm saying, well, I'm just trying to keep up with you, man.
Amazing. What's happening with that record? Because it's not, I don't think it's on Spotify.
Well, you know, we recorded 15 songs and they were split between two albums. The first one was the evil one on CBS UK. And then TEO, which is the evil one, right? Abbreviated. The first one had the wild collage color photo, yeah. Album cover done by Captain Colors, who was another local legend artist. Then the second one, TEO, was on 415 Records, Howie Stein's label in San Francisco. And that had the black and white with the open door and the light shining through it. And so we got two albums out of these 15 songs. So there was obviously some duplication between the releases, but one was a foreign release and the other was a domestic release. So we didn't really, nobody seemed to mind. I mean, nobody at the labels minded. Everybody liked the songs. And now, since then, it's been re-released and re-released and re-released and re-released. The last really good release was a three-album anthology called by a label in Pacific Northwest called Light in the Attic.
Yeah.
And the first album is my 15 songs. And the second album has a lot of other people's recordings and live recordings, later recordings. I think Dwayne might have produced some of them. And I'm not sure what's on the third one. More outtakes and stuff like that. But it's a pretty complete Rocky collection. Somewhere around here, I have it all on vinyl. You know, it was a really nice package. And now, actually, other people are starting to cover Rocky songs.
Yeah.
I forget her name. I think her name is Chelsea. I can't remember her last name, but she did a absolutely spooky version of one of my favorites. If You Have Ghosts, You Have Everything.
Yeah.
And it's just sound. It's on a soundtrack for a film, but it's really dark and very echoey and very slow. And it's more like a sung poem than a rock song, but it's definitely Rocky. And that's one of my favorite songs. I Think of Demons, If You Have Ghosts. To me, those are like Rocky doing love songs.
Yeah. Amazing. Well, Stu, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for the great contribution on all fronts to music history. And I wish
you're welcome.
So much luck in retirement and enjoying the non-touring lifestyle.
Yeah, with my nuclear family, I got four kids, six grandkids, probably more on the way now that my youngest son just got hitched.
Beautiful.
So I'm pretty busy, you know, if I'm not on stage anymore, which I, like I said earlier, I do miss. I got other things. Now I can, you know, well, see which one of my grandkids wants to play. Both of my granddaughters play and sing. One's a drummer. Both of them play guitar. They both sing real good. They're like 6 and 8 years old.
Well, so, you got a new band you could join. It's right built in for you.
Yeah, it's, you know, I give them all the encouragement I can. I, you know, they're little young for full-size instruments yet. Although one of them plays my son's electronic drum set pretty good, you know, and teaching herself, you know, listens the same way, you know. I'm originally classically trained, but as I got more and more into popular music, I became more of an ear player. And so they're listening to records and teaching themselves how to play the drum parts and the guitar parts that they hear. And they both take guitar lessons. I think they might both be taking drum lessons as well now. I think we got them both drum lessons for Christmas. Whatever one gets, the other one wants. So, anyway, you know, life is good. I just hope I can get enough of it.
Thank you so much, Stu. I appreciate everything. You be well.
Cheers, Scott.
Cheers. Thank you for listening to the Legends Podcast by All Day Vinyl. If you enjoyed this episode, please rate it, share it, subscribe, and follow us and check us out at All Day Vinyl on Instagram and YouTube.